I'm Matthew Smith, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Connor Cyrus. It's been a busy week for the legislature. We've had the governor's State of the State address, the start of the state legislative session, and all political parties making their promises to Vermonters. But as we start this session, there are some big topics left over from last year, including how the state plans to address the rising number of COVID cases in the state. And I'm going to point it out that from what we've heard this week, neither Governor Phil Scott nor House Speaker Joe Kowinski or Senate President Becca Ballant have put forth any new initiatives to slow the spread of COVID right now. To help us break down all of this, we have an elite group of political journalists to answer your questions and help provide context to some of the biggest issues that will be discussed in Montpelier. We have Calvin Cutler from WCIX. Calvin, welcome.
Thanks, Connor.
We have Lola Dufour from Vermont Digger. Lola, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
And we have Peter Hirschfeld from VPR. Peter, welcome.
I've never been called elite before, Connor, so thank you for that.
You're very welcome. Now, Lola, I'm going to start with you, and I just want to get your reaction to the governor's State of the State address.
Well, it was interesting that the governor made an interesting choice. He chose to, you know, instead of focusing on COVID-19, which might have been a natural thing to focus on, given that the state is once again shattering records, and facing the Omicron surge, and, you know, for the second year in a row, he delivered his address remotely. He chose to focus not on the present, but on, you know, what he says is a bright future for Vermont. And that's in large part because we have a lot of federal money to spend on kind of long deferred priorities. And that's what he focused on in his speech. So he focused on the future, and he also, you know, went back to past themes. He talked about things that he has been talking about for maybe 6 years now, which is the high cost of living in Vermont, taxes, and our workforce problems and our demographic problems.
And Calvin, go ahead, continue.
And, you know, I think there were probably quite a few people that were happy not to listen to something, you know, discussing COVID. And there were plenty also who reacted by, you know, saying that this was tone deaf given the current state of conditions in Vermont.
And Calvin, what was your reaction to all of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think Lola really hit the nail on the head, sort of. You know, there's kind of two ways of looking at the speech, right? I mean, you know, in the present, you know, we're still dealing with coronavirus, record high case counts, or, you know, kind of looking toward the future and learning to live with the virus and looking to our underlying issues that the state has seen. I think really what's been really fascinating is, you know, just the amount of money, some of these initiatives that the governor was talking about. You know, he said that there was over 200 million that he wants to put into housing, which, you know, he described as being really a cornerstone of a workforce. You know, and some of these figures, granted, we'll get a more specific, you know, picture of how some of these initiatives will be funded next month. It's really remarkable to see some of these initiatives and just the torrent of federal cash that we're continuing to see here in Vermont.
And Peter, after the governor gave his State of the State address, the Democrats, Jill Kowinski and Becca Ballant, who are the Speaker of the House and Senate President, they gave a response. What was your reaction to their response?
I was struck by how much overlap there is, Connor, between the priorities that Kowinski and Ballant outlined in their Democratic response with the agenda that we saw the governor put out there in his State of the State address, and that I'll think we'll see him reinforce when he delivers his budget address later this month. They were asked after they sort of gave their prepared remarks, what we're hearing from you is largely similar to what we're hearing from the governor. Can you point out areas in which you foresee disagreements or places that are going to reveal differences in your ideological approaches to the operation of running state government? And they said, you know, I think that we are hearing the same thing from Vermonters that the governor is, that they're worried about workforce, they're worried about childcare, they're worried about housing. And because of that, you're seeing our legislative agenda line up pretty neatly with what the governor put out today. They did indicate, though, that the question of how to accomplish those things is where we may see some differences emerge in between the two approaches. And so it's going to be interesting as this legislative session progresses to see whether or not they're able to find consensus on some of the larger spending initiatives that both branches are looking to move forward with.
Now, as I mentioned earlier, COVID was really left out of this conversation. The governor and the Dems both passively acknowledged it, but one of the top priorities for the Dems is to work on a COVID response plan. Now, for grim numbers, we are seeing the highest daily case counts ever. We now have a positivity rate of 12.7% and over 2,000 new cases reported yesterday. Here's Senate President Becca Ballen speaking to the exhaustion we're all feeling around the pandemic on Vermont Edition Wednesday.
People understand the moment that we're in right now in this pandemic. We are almost 2 years in. Our constituents are exhausted. Our families can't work any harder. Our schools and healthcare services cannot work any harder. We have to be absolutely focused on working together within our party, across party lines, and with the governor. That's what Vermonters want us to do. That is what we will do.
Lola, obviously the pandemic is shaping every aspect of our lives right now. How will it factor into this session?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question. So we know, or legislative leadership has said that, you know, a statewide mask mandate will be taken out at some point this session, and such a bill has already been introduced. But as far as I can tell, there hasn't, I mean, maybe there will be, but so far we haven't seen evidence of an effort to fast track it. And I mean, that's interesting because Democratic leadership really heavily criticized the governor for not taking this up. They've also, you know, said that, well, they'll take it up on some level. There's no point because they expect him to veto it and they don't think that they have the votes to veto it. But we have not yet seen kind of an alternative vision fleshed out by the legislature.
I do want to make note that the state positivity rate as of today went down. It's actually 12.6%. But Calvin, as we're talking about the upcoming legislative session and COVID, can we expect to see any more cooperation with these high case numbers and high positivity rate from the governor and the legislature?
You know, I think that's an interesting question, Connor. You know, I think, I guess, what does cooperation mean, I think, is the question. You know, as Lola pointed out, we'd, you know, heard from legislative leaders really publicly disagreeing with the governor. And as she mentioned, there is the bill introduced on the House side. The Senate, I can tell, is taking it a little slower. They're taking testimony in Senate Health and Welfare to try to, you know, mirror some sort of data-driven statewide mask mandate like we've seen in other states. But I think where the, you know, agreement really can come through is, you know, initiatives in testing, in vaccinations, in other mitigation measures. And of course, there's still money to be spent with, you know, HVAC systems within schools and workplaces and others. So I think the mask mandate question, in my discussions with lawmakers is really kind of one slice of the COVID picture. And, you know, mitigating the risk and keeping our cases under control, it's going to take more than just, you know, a statewide mask mandate, but it certainly is one tool in the toolbox that lawmakers have. But I think we could see some agreement with the administration and the legislature in other areas. But I've yet to see any bill or any policy really put forward that would address that.
And Peter, I've asked you this several times after the press briefings, but what do you think it's going to take to get the governor to instate stricter COVID-19 safety measures?
I think based on what we've seen from the governor to date, Connor, It would require a level of crisis in hospitals that we haven't seen yet. Talking about people being turned away from ICU beds, talking about there not being enough inpatient capacity to serve people who have critical care needs. The fact that the governor issued a State of the State address on a day on which I believe Vermont saw the highest number of cases it's ever had before, and really used that speech as a moment to celebrate everything that the state has done so far as it relates to vaccination rates, as it relates to getting kids back into school for in-person learning, cements his belief that his administration's approach to COVID mitigation has been the right one, and that notwithstanding these pandemic high case counts we've seen, that he believes Vermont is on the right track, that we've adopted the right strategies, and that he, as far as he's concerned right now, it's going to be steady as she goes.
And listeners, you can join the conversation if you have questions for this group of journalists, anything about what's happening in the legislature, about bills that are being proposed, about the process, or just questions that you want them to ask your legislators. Give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. That number again, 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to Mike in Bridgewater Corners. Mike, you're on the show.
Yes, I'd like to know where the governor's red line is on deaths or hospital incapacitation to handle people. What's the red line there? How many people have to die before a mask mandate is in place?
Mike, thanks for that question. Let's go. I guess, Peter, I'm just going to let you reiterate what you just said.
The governor has been very clear not to issue any red lines. I can recall during the middle of the Delta surge, he threw out the figure, well, you know, if we were around 80 hospitalizations per day due to COVID, that would be a number that would give me some concern. Well, we've hit that point pretty regularly over the past month, and we haven't seen any indication from him that that's going to be cause to change his approach. If there's a red line, the governor has been pretty careful not to tell us what it is. We know that there are contingency plans going on in the background. He hasn't been very open about what those are looking like. But it seems to have to do with critical care capacity in Vermont hospitals. What level of capacity crunch we would have to deal with is an open question and one that at this point it seems only the administration knows.
And as of today, we have 482 deaths, and hospitalizations are down 84 from the low 90s yesterday. And one of the big takeaways from the governor's State of the State address is Vermont's workforce shortage. Let's hear how the governor put it. He starts off by referring to the unsettling state of Vermont's workforce back in 2020.
I reported at the time that only three counties had added workers, while the other 11 had lost them. Unfortunately, today, all 14 have lost workers, even Chittenden. With Windsor, Windham, Caledonia, Bennington, Essex, and Rutland down 15% or more since their peak. Statewide, we've seen our workforce decrease by nearly 30,000 since 2010.
Now, since 2010, that was, 12 years ago. And that was, so let me just start by saying that was Governor Scott in his State of the State address on Tuesday. So 2010 was 12 years ago. And so clearly this isn't a new issue. Lola, what has the governor really pushing this now?
Well, I mean, our workforce problems are more acute than they have ever been, it seems like. What's interesting is that even though the problem seems to have gotten worse and seems to be, seems to be rooted in old conditions, but has changed because of the pandemic, many of the ideas that he brought out are ideas that he has brought out before. One is the remote worker relocation program, which, Vermont made headlines for pre-pandemic, for basically paying people to move here. I'm wondering what kind of reception it will get in the legislature now that we've kind of experienced with the pandemic a wave of people moving here, and kind of encountered problems there. Right, we found that we don't have housing. a big thing that he is pushing in terms of workforce development is building more housing. And as Calvin has pointed out, we're going to see really a huge tranche of money, federal money, get pushed out this legislative session to address that. The governor wants $80 million in the BAA. That's this kind of mid-year budget adjustment, which would push money out the door kind of right away, plus another $100 million in the big bill, the big budget bill that comes later on in the session. And legislative leadership have said that they're definitely on board to spend a lot of money on housing. So we know that a ton of money is going to get pushed out. The question is going to be what the details look like. And I think we'll see, you know, slight differences in policy preferences come out there. But I would be stunned if we weren't approaching $200 million on housing this session.
Now, we are going to get into a housing conversation later, but I do want to focus on a way the governor wants to help with the workforce shortage is by destigmatizing the trades and getting more Vermont students interested in CTE. Now, to note, we will dive into CTE or Career and Technical Education on Wednesday's Vermont edition. But I do want to ask Calvin, does getting more Vermont students involved in the trades actually help to address the workforce shortage?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's certainly the governor's view, and you know, one way that he's really trying to tackle the workforce shortage, because you know we are seeing shortages in some of those professions, right? Whether it be childcare or healthcare, you know, he talked a lot about carpenters and plumbers and other people in skilled trades, and so those are some of the places that we're really seeing some of the most acute shortages. Even as this pandemic, we're coming up on, you know, 3 years of it here. So it's, you know, I think that's the governor's real kind of strategy, is to try to, you know, put a focus on those through, you know, career technical centers, and, you know, also working with state colleges and others. So I think that's his main goal with the workforce in the careers, so to speak. But, you know, it really is a interconnected web of topics, right, and of, you know, issues that, you know, the workforce and housing and affordability, all of these things that we really heard the governor say really since he was elected.
And, Peter, this workforce shortage, what plans, what are the tangible plans that the governor put in place to address this?
So, you know, leaving aside some of the complementary approaches, i.e. housing, investments in childcare, things about that are going to make either cost of living or quality of life such that people want to live in Vermont and work here, the direct workforce development initiatives consist of this multi-layered combination of financial inducements that Vermont can use to either recruit, retain, attract, or train up people to join the workforce. We're going to see him in his budget address announce another relocation incentive, right? And this is going to be looking across the country and outside the country to identify people that may have an interest in moving to Vermont, and then creating a financial package that is going to get them to make the decision to do that. We're seeing in the budget adjustment proposal that he just put forward more than $30 million worth of retention bonuses that will be going toward existing state employees and a lot of the folks that are delivering frontline healthcare services at our mental health agencies and our visiting nurses associations, for example. Really, you get the sense they're throwing everything they can find at the wall, hoping some of it sticks, and hoping the part that does stick is going to be enough to meaningfully address the vacancy rates that are opening up in sectors all across the state right now.
Now, let's go to Rebecca in Woodstock. Rebecca, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hello there.
What question do you have?
I had a comment.
Oh, let's hear it.
I'm going to take the quote from Governor Scott. If you're digging a hole, if you're digging yourself in a hole, stop digging. And the comment is, if we're so highly vaccinated and we're and the numbers are still going up, why aren't we looking the other way and giving people support to improve their immune system and have supplements and or medications at home so they don't have to go to the hospital and it would reduce their fear?
Lola, let's have you answer that question. Is there any plans to help with, I guess, the aftermath of COVID or to help more at-home remedies with COVID?
I guess I'm a little confused by the question. I mean, the administration is putting more focus on, you know, on treatment, and certainly they just announced yesterday a plan to send 500,000 rapid tests out to Vermonters via the mail if they order them, which mirrors a federal initiative. So there are other things that the governor is exploring, although he, you know, certainly has his critics that wish that he were, for example, pushing harder on masking and on, you know, also perhaps sending actual masks to folks, better quality masks. But I feel like the caller was implying that we shouldn't be pushing vaccination, which public health experts agree is absolutely a cornerstone of, you know, yeah, keeping people as healthy as possible.
Yeah, I think that it ignores the fact that the governor is really pushing vaccinations and that we're not at the point yet in the state where we can focus on how to treat people at home. Let's continue with the phones. Let's go to Hunter in Fairfax. Hunter, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi. Yeah, my name's Hunter from Fairfax. Colin, wondering what the governor or the state's legislature's thoughts are on how to manage daycare, COVID exposures, and working parents' responsibilities to manage their work responsibilities as well. Working on our fourth COVID exposure now, after only having one day back at daycare this week after the contact tracing took 11 days to reach us on Sunday of this Sunday after being out for a week previously. So that's getting pretty trying. Obviously, we understand daycares need to cover their overhead and we continue to pay, but it just feels like working families are really, really bearing the brunt at this point in time. So wondering if there's any plans to improve that condition.
Peter, let's go to you. What's the state doing to improve those conditions?
I listened to Education Secretary Dan French addressing the Senate Education Committee earlier this week. He acknowledged that one of the shortcomings in the rapid antigen test kit distribution system for schools in the run-up to the holidays, or I guess after the holidays before kids came back to school, was that it did not include pre-K, early childhood ed institutions that aren't part of those K-12 school structures. He said that's something they're going to be looking to remedy, that they're going to be looking for ways to include the early childhood education and daycare universes in those rapid testing programs. Beyond that, I think the legislature, in terms of how it's going to make its mark on the state's COVID response, has been very attuned to the concerns they've heard from schools about the lack of support that they've gotten in terms of administering test to stay, for example, in terms of dealing with all the knock-on effects that are a direct result of students in their schools, staff coming down with COVID and having to deal with different contingency plans. I suspect, though I haven't seen any specific proposals come from lawmakers yet, that we will see some effort to guide resources towards institutions, organizations in this state that are responsible for caring for Vermont's kids while their parents are at work. So more to come on that front would be my guess.
Listeners, we are talking to Peter Hirschfeld, we are talking to Lola Dufour, and Calvin Cutler, all Vermont political journalists. If you have questions for them, you can call us 1-800-639-2211. Now, before the break, we were talking about the challenges of growing Vermont's workforce. And as many have acknowledged, the issue is tethered to another major pressure point in Vermont, a lack of affordable housing.
We must recognize housing policy is workforce policy. If you'll work with me in budget adjustment to allocate $80 million more, we can show we're fully committed to this cause. And in the budget I'll present in 2 weeks, you can expect to see another $100 million. Because it's time to get serious about putting the benefits of a good home and a good investment within the reach of every Vermonter.
That was Governor Phil Scott on Tuesday during his State of the State address. Now, Calvin, what does that mean? So if I'm listening at home to that, what does that mean for me?
Oh, well, I think it means that, you know, the governor is really trying to put a huge emphasis on housing. And certainly we, you know, in the past 2 years with all of the federal money that's come in, you know, the state and the legislature has made really big investments in housing already. But I think, you know, it was also key in the governor's speech. He said that he wanted to work with lawmakers and put election year politics aside and really kind of focus on the issues that matter. And, you know, from just about everybody I hear from, it is housing. You know, up and down the affordability scale, from, you know, low income, potentially subsidized housing to what's called, you know, the missing middle, right? Middle income family homes. And so, you know, you can put as much money as you can into it and, you know, incentivize building. But there's other prongs to this conversation as well that, you know, the governor pointed out, such as, you know, Act 250 and local land use regulation reform. Those are going to be really critical issues in terms of, you know, where people can build, how developers can build out sewer lines and water lines, because, of course, you have to have the infrastructure to support the housing as well. And also with tax credits for downtown and potential exemptions of Act 250 too. So it's a pretty complex and really interwoven discussion when you talk about housing. But I think, you know, the bottom line is that state leaders, both in the legislature and in the executive branch, they see and hear every day from their constituents just the acute housing shortage and really the negative effect that it's having on Vermont and our economy too.
And Lola, what are your thoughts when it comes to what the governor said about trying to create more affordable housing?
Well, you know, as Calvin said, it is something that we are hearing absolutely from everybody. He is trying a multi-pronged approach. You know, he wants an extra $50 million right away to support additional mixed income and multifamily rentals, plus shelter capacity, increasing shelter capacity. And that's mostly to target the folks who are expected to, you know, exit the hotel and motel voucher program and who, you know, do not otherwise have housing. There is also another $20 million that would support affordable apartment and accessory dwelling, so ADU unit creation. This is for existing properties. This would be with a focus on vacant and code-violating properties. So this is basically rehabbing properties that aren't in good enough shape to provide housing right now. Between the two of those, we're looking at, you know, about 650 units is the hope. There's also $5 million that the governor wants to spend, again, immediately on this quote-unquote missing middle-income homeownership program that would serve as this sort of pilot to see if we can create more housing for, you know, middle-income families who find themselves just out of reach, who find home ownership just out of reach. So much like workforce in general, there's this attempt to try just many different things to see what sticks and what helps. And again, this is just the pot of money that the governor wants to spend right away. And so we will see probably in the next week or so what the the legislative responses to that, because this comes in the budget adjustment, which is this like mid-year budget act. And they have to act on that very quickly.
All right, we're going to transition over to Middleton. Andrea, welcome to Vermont Edition. What's your question or comment?
Hi, I'm actually from Milton.
Oh, sorry. Andrea from Milton.
That's okay. I just want to say that I really am very supportive of Phil Scott. However, my heart kind of breaks when I hear that we're looking at incentivizing people moving to Vermont with all of our housing shortages, et cetera. So I am in support of supporting and empowering people who already live here. I've raised three kids. I was a stay-at-home mom, and I also am a nurse with a bachelor's and master's degree. But I'm struggling financially right now as a divorced woman. I have lots of skills and passion and excitement to help our community, but it's very unaffordable to live here as a single woman. I'm starting a business, and it makes me sad that I'm looking at getting a roommate or moving out of state when I'm so tied to Vermont, just because it's becoming unaffordable to live here. And I just want to say that nurses don't always make a livable wage. I made actually less than I did when I collected some unemployment recently as a nurse working full time than I did on unemployment for a short term.
Andrea, thank you so much. Thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Donna in South Burlington. Donna, you're on the line. What's your question or comment?
Yes, thanks for taking my call. Related to the governor's thoughts about getting more people to go into construction trades, and there's a real effort to try to register and educate existing contractors more in the state, and the governor vetoed that last year, which seems kind of at opposite ends of the idea of elevating contractors to the highly technical jobs that they are, and the need for education. So I think, I definitely support the thoughts to elevate the construction trades and get more people to go into them, but we also need to, at least know who's doing these things and get the people who have been doing these jobs for maybe 20 years educated up to current standards, because those people. So I'm just sort of putting in a plug that, we need to recognize the building trades a lot more than we do to get more people to go into them.
Thank you so much for that, Donna. Now, Peter, how do you I know this is kind of getting in the weeds a little bit, but do you remember what the logic was from the governor in vetoing that bill last year?
I'm going to confess ignorance. I know the governor vetoed a bill that would have required a rental registry in the state. I am unaware of a veto of a bill that would have required contractors to register. If Lola or Calvin have this top of mind, I'll happily defer to them.
I will try. We'll just go down the line. Lola, do you remember?
I do not know about this.
Okay. Calvin?
Yeah, I have to say the same, but this is definitely something to look into, though. It's a good story idea.
Absolutely. And so now let's go to Queechee. Let's go to Honey. Honey, you're on the line. What's your question or comment?
Thank you. My comment would be that I don't think there's anything more to be said by anyone in government trying to persuade people to do the right thing for COVID. There's no point in the governor getting up and talking about the numbers and about the ICU, because it's awful. It's awful what's going on. But the people who are so arrogant that they don't want to get the shots, they don't want to get the booster, they don't want to wear the mask, and they're not going to, no matter what any of us say or do. So we may as well go on by being in the present and in the future of how can we make the state better. So I was very pleased with his talk.
Thank you so much for that, Beth. I just want to say that, public health experts do say that wearing a mask and getting vaccinated and boosted is the best way to keep you and your family safe from this. We do have Beth back from Brattleboro. Beth, welcome to Vermont Edition. What's your question or comment?
Hi. I just want to say I'm a nurse. I hang out with a lot of nurses. I have a nurse daughter. And to kind of back up what that woman a couple minutes ago said, the salaries really are a problem for nurses in the state, especially given that we're surrounded by three states that all pay more and that are all easy to get to. I understand the bonus piece, but for anybody who has been, and this is also for childcare, for anyone who's ever been salaried, bonuses, although you wouldn't refuse them, are a tiny bit of an insult because they don't reflect the institution's commitment to retain and you know, continue with affordable living for the employees. So it was just a push. I don't believe the state has much control over how much hospitals and childcare organizations pay. However, it's just, I think I just needed to comment on the bonus piece.
Can I
jump
in on this? Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's a very interesting point. I've done a lot of reporting these last couple of years on childcare, and this is something that I've heard again and again from childcare providers, which is that all of this one-time money is great and so needed and appreciated, but it's very hard to use one-time money to fix a long-standing problem, right? Like, how do you convince folks to stay in underpaid professions like childcare when you can only offer them like, you know, a $2,000 or $3,000 bonus right now, right? Because people stay in professions based on long-term planning. You know, it's hard also for state leaders to use this moment to fix those underlying problems because they also just have one-time money to work with. And so I think that is going to be a big tension and big problem for state leaders to tackle this session. And I haven't really seen many kind of great ideas for dealing with that. Because again, it requires money that the feds are fixing a lot of problems by sending Vermont so much one-time money, but these ongoing obligations are going to remain very vexing for our state leaders.
I now want to turn to pensions. It's not the sexiest topic, but certainly one that has dire implications for state budgets, obligations, and credit worthiness in the years to come. The issue of pension reform has been looming over lawmakers for some time now, and it's continuously getting passed down. The Democrats say pension reform is a top priority this year. Senate Pro Tem Becca Ballant spoke with Vermont Edition on Wednesday and says an agreement could be close.
Where we are right now in terms of the conversations with our unions around pensions is that we have been in a really careful, constructive conversation for months, and we feel like we are getting closer to an agreement that we all can get behind.
Now, Lola, we've talked about pensions before on Vermont This Week. This is an issue that got punted from last session. What can we expect this session?
I really don't know what to expect this session.
I mean, the best way to describe this is a mess, but, you know, what can we expect?
Yes. I mean, this is an explosive topic. It's a lot of money. Any solution is going to require a lot of pain from quite a few parties, and it's an election year. So I don't know what to expect. As you've noted, the legislature tried to kind of take a first pass at this last session, and it blew up in their face. There was enormous backlash. They immediately kind of took back their idea. And they struck this task force that was supposed to meet over the summer, and you know was supposed to kind of come up with a reform idea to put before the legislature before they reconvened. The legislature has reconvened. That task force has still not proposed something, although they are expected to shortly. You know, in kind of the waning days of the. Of the pre-holiday period, they were still having very testy conversations, and it seemed like the unions and key lawmakers were still very far apart on kind of what a framework for a deal would even look like. I take the Senate pro tem at her word when, you know, she says that she hopes and thinks that maybe they may indeed be close to a deal. I think that there have been a lot of very intense conversations happening recently. And I think the unions, you know, probably don't want to walk away from a deal right now, given the fact that Vermont has more money to throw at the problem than it probably ever will have again. And so I think they probably know that now is the time to strike a deal. As to what is going to be in that deal, I'm waiting with bated breath to see what it will indeed look like.
You and me both. I think a lot of teachers and a lot of people who have been following this issue are all waiting. Peter, what are the financial, like, what does this mean financially? I mean, we know that there's serious financial ramifications to this, and it keeps getting pushed down. What does this mean, and where are we financially?
So there's enormous financial ramifications. I mean, the effect of compounding over time, whether it's in the form of benefits, retirement benefits for teachers and state employees, or in the form of contributions from the state, are enormous. The stakes are extraordinarily high. It's not just about the money, though, right now. I mean, when you talk to school administrators and teachers, a lot of them are at a breaking point. We're going to get some numbers, I think, next week in terms of how many educators have left the field over the past 2 years. But I've talked to school administrators who say their sixth grade class is on its fourth teacher of the year because people are leaving. That is a context that lawmakers are going to have to pay very close attention to as they consider not just the financial ramifications of this plan, but the psychological effects on teachers who really need to be given a reason to stay in that classroom that they're in right now, where they're dealing with some really difficult things. So I'm hearing a lot of lawmakers talk about sources to increase state contributions that I hadn't heard during this conversation last year. When I hear people talking about the surplus in the education fund, when I hear them talking about general fund surpluses, there seems to be a little bit of an indication that they're game to use some of that money to try to put some down payments on these unfunded liabilities that will decrease the concessions that are going to be needed from employees to close that gap. So I'm with you all. I'm really looking forward to seeing not just what's in the proposal when it's unveiled, I think probably next week, but perhaps more importantly, the reaction from rank and file union members.
Now let's go to the phones. Let's go to Jenna in Burlington. Jenna, welcome to Vermont Edition. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, hi, thank you. So I'm wondering why we're not using some of our one-time funding to support our most vulnerable population, being children, where they don't have the ability to choose, oh, I'm going to get a job somewhere else because people aren't wearing masks, or they don't get to choose whether they get a vaccine or not. Why are we not providing them with N95s, more space, shelter outside to eat in a safer environment? We're pretending that the virus is going to take a break or a time out when they're having a snack. And it just makes no sense. We have all this one-time spending. This isn't even the last pandemic that we'll see. So we should be building infrastructure for them for next time. We already know that they have to be there is the position that families, doctors, and the government are taking. So we should be protecting them as best we can. Why aren't we?
Calvin, let's take that question to you. A lot of one-time spending money, why is that not going towards children?
Yeah, I mean, I think there has been some money that has gone out already through ESSER 1 and ESSER 2. Those were passed through the American Rescue Plan last year. But, of course, that was all pre-Delta and pre-Omicron. And the caller is right that, you know, kids really are in a tough spot. You know, especially one of our callers earlier talked about kids in pre-K and childcare. Some of the kids that are, you know, too young to get the vaccine already. So I think that's certainly been, you know, kind of the frustration of many educators that I've spoken with, is that there's just been kind of a lack of clarity of guidance, from the agency of education as to where we are right now in the pandemic and what schools should be doing to keep kids safe. Certainly, you know, we know that vaccines are, you know, the cornerstone of the response, and masking and social distancing and all of these other factors play a role in these discussions. But in terms of where dollars can be put, in terms of, you know, whether it be giving more resources, you know, for kids or, you know, HVAC systems or things like that, you know, that's something I haven't really heard a lot of that conversation as
can
of,
I jump in?
At least as recently.
Yes, Lola, let's hear from you.
I've also done a lot of reporting on schools and childcare, and you know, the thing I hear again and again from administrators and childcare providers, well, especially from administrators on the school side, because a lot less money has been spent on childcare. But especially on the school side, it hasn't been a question of money, because a ton of money actually has gone to schools. But the big concern and the breakdowns have mostly been around, you know, planning and staffing. And the criticism that I hear again and again from school administrators regarding the state's response is that plans have come too late and they have come with very little support. And I think an excellent example of this is, you know, the state announced that it would distribute rapid tests for all K-12 kids before the holidays ended. But this announcement came very late. And, you know, only half of all the tests got distributed and were actually, you know, in hands before the start of school. And so I think that has been the theme of the problem, right, is that because of kind of a reactive response that hasn't come with a lot of manpower support, that has been the problem.
Lola, I hate to cut you off. We can discuss we have so much more to discuss, and we will do that in another show. But for now, I have to say goodbye. Lola Dufour of Vermont Digger, thank you so much for being here. Peter Hirschfeld of VPR, thank you so much. And Calvin Cutler from WCIX, thank you guys.